today's episode, I have Mrs. Jessica Glass, wife, mother, therapist, founder of a local mental health private practice in Houston, Texas, Right Mentality, and so much more. This episode will be about her story to becoming a businesswoman in the field of mental health and, of course, the balance. Similar to pageantry, my love for mental health is infinite. Hope you tune in and learn from this Innervate Her.
So how are you today?
I'm great. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. Just chilling. Just got off work. So been a long day.
Oh, trust me. I know how it is.
So the listeners have heard a little bit from me about who you are, but would you like to kind of go more in depth about yourself? So if you could introduce yourself to the listeners.
Well, hello, listeners. First, I would like to say thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
My name is Jessica Walden Glass. I am a licensed professional counselor and a licensed chemical dependence counselor in the state of Texas. I am from Jackson, Mississippi. Whoop, whoop. I currently reside in the outskirts of Houston and Richmond, Texas. I own a private practice called Right Mentality that has two locations. So that's pretty much a general synopsis about me.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. So, you know, it isn't every day that you kind of come across someone that's under 30 years old that is moving like you are. Providing opportunities for clinicians in the field of mental health counseling. So could you pretty much tell us your story about how all of this came about?
Oh, wow. Not to give you all the long, drawn out story about how it came out. So you won't probably believe it, but my career choice was to be an anesthesiologist.
Hmm.
I started off at Mississippi State. I was in the pre-med track. And I could not pass biology to save my life. I was struggling in biology, and that was my major. So I was like, okay, so I don't know what to do. So like most people, they go to their counselor and they kind of talk about their grades and what can they do to make sure they don't, you know, fell out of class. So my counselor looked at my overall grades, and she said, well, you do really well in anything behavior wise. You're exceptional in psychology. Have you ever thought about psychology? And I'm like, no, never. So we end up switching me to psychology because she felt like once I got into the field that it might be something that I would love. And unbeknownst to me, it manifests a deeper love for me with psychology. I love studying behavior. I love studying sociology. I love studying anything related to basically why we do the things that we do and the chemical imbalances in our brain. Mm-hmm. So no one told me after I graduated from Mississippi State that I needed a master's degree to at least make anything competitive in the field.
Yes.
And so I applied. I end up getting into now my mind is going blank, and I haven't been out of Mississippi that long. What is the college in Clinton?
Mississippi College.
And the reason I can't remember is because I was only there for like 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got into Mississippi College, and I was in for 3 weeks, and then I forgot that I even applied to Texas Southern in Houston, Texas.
Oh, wow.
And I had applied the year before, and I never got an acceptance letter. I never got anything. So I just, you know, went with a plan B, was to stay local. So Mississippi College, I got on board, and I was in 3 weeks. And then I got an email saying, hey, come down for orientation. So I immediately withdrew from Mississippi College because my plan was to move out of state. I got into Texas Southern. I studied clinical community psychology at Texas Southern. I graduated in 2016. Then after doing my tenure at Texas Southern, that's when I found out I needed a license to practice. And so everything was like a hiccup. It was like, it was no roadmap to like, hey, this is what you need to at least make anything competitive in the field. And so once I graduated, I sat for the exam. It's kind of different in Mississippi from what I've been hearing. I think your all's process is a little different, but here you sit for the exam and then you start accruing your 3,000 hours. It took me literally 18 months because I worked in a hospital setting, which was 24 hours. So I was able to gain my hours much quicker than someone who was working a typical 8-to-5 or 9-to-5. So I was able to work late nights, you know, 12-hour shifts, getting my hours in the mental health psychology field. So then after that, I always knew I wanted to be a business owner. I knew I didn't want to, you know, really work in the fast-paced hospital setting. I wanted something more calmer. I wanted to meet people before they got to the stage of acuity. So I started to build things for my private practice. So while I was an intern, I was, you know, getting EIN numbers, registering my business name. I was building a website by myself. I was looking at office spaces. So on February the 14th, 2019, my licensure status said LPC. I was no longer an intern, and it was the same day I went to get keys to my office.
Oh, wow.
And so I, at the time, I only had one client who was paying me $50. So I was really running off faith. I didn't know how it was going to work, but I still had my full-time job, which was good, which could supplement income in the time that I built my clientele. I started applying for insurance panels on my own. I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have anyone to guide me along that process, which I really wish I did. But at the time, money was tight, so I couldn't really pay anyone to teach me the ropes. So I used all the knowledge that I had from all my other jobs, which at the hospital setting, I did billing and I did intake. So I knew billing and I knew how to, you know, get on the insurance panel. So I knew that. And then I used everything else for my other jobs, like residential treatment fees and your local treatment centers. Like I gathered things from working with them and I kind of brought it over to my private practice. So that was February the 14th. For the longest, I had about one or two clients for about a couple of months. So I wasn't even, you know, making rent. And then by April and May, it started to take off. I started to get calls. I started, people started seeking me out. I started doing public speaking events. I started to kind of put my name out there so people could know who I was. I started asking clients to leave reviews, you know, anonymous reviews for me. That way people will start to see my name generate once they were looking for therapists. And then after I got on insurance panels, it kind of took off from there because insurance panels market for you. After that, about October into the year of last year, I was like, hey, I want a second office. I kind of want to open up and expand my niche a little bit and kind of open in the northern side of Houston. And I did that. And I was able to contract some therapists to work that location and kind of get that side up and running. And so that's kind of my backstory of how I ended up in the mental health field. It was kind of fell in my lap, but once it did and I felt like I fell in love with it, it took off from there. I didn't see myself doing anything. Granted, the salary of an anesthesiologist right now would be pretty good, but I don't think I would love it as much as I do mental health.
Gotcha. Which, you know, I don't think it fell in your lap, Jessica. I think it might have been your calling.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because I guess being in this field is kind of one of those, like, of course, like, teachers, people, you know, love, typically they love children, they love the development of kids and everything, but, like, mental health in any part of the social sciences is kind of like, okay, you really have to have a love for just out there and moving, even if everything is falling apart, you still have to look at the end result. So
that is very true.
Just like kudos to you, kudos to everybody out there that's like working, especially at a time like this where everything is very uncertain. people are identifying a lot of the like socioeconomical situations that's arising from COVID-19. Mm-hmm. They're also identifying like all of like the I guess the physiological stuff that's going on like with our bodies, but they are not identifying a lot of stuff dealing with mental health. And I think that's like the, it's not an underdog, but that's like the underlining of all of this, because it's almost like hell breaking loose everywhere. Mm-hmm. And our minds are strong. Oh, it's a strong muscle, but it is not strong dealing with pressure, depression, and everything, you know, like helplessness, hopelessness, just dealing with finances and people losing their jobs and stuff like Definitely. That, or just sickness and death and people not being around their loved ones at a time of death, at a time of happiness. You know, mothers are just in a room giving birth with one person in mm-hmm. there. So it's kind of like, it's going to be, I guess work is going to be definitely cut out in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if you for it, but it is cut out. What do you think? Will there be a huge surge or influx of individuals that will be coming to you for services, just coming to anybody for services at a time like this? Or, you know, what is your thoughts on, I guess, the field of mental health or just mental health professionals fighting this crisis?
That's a great question. So I've been in contact with a lot of mental health professionals in my local area, and we've been doing a lot of brainstorming, and we've been trying to fight the good fight. And a lot of us are seeing that our clientele is up and down. You know, one week we might have a good, strong caseload, and then the next we start to see that our clients are dwindling, not because they don't want the treatment, but because, one, they're either being furloughed and they're losing their jobs and they're trying to focus on finances, or two, if they lose their job, they're losing their healthcare benefits, and two, if they're losing their job, they're not able to pay out of pocket for therapy sessions. So that is one battle in itself, and then you have the other battle of people who still have their jobs and still want to seek therapy, but they're unsure about how telemental health works. That means that you can see a therapist virtually, kind of like if you would through a Zoom or a Skype, but it's HIPAA compliant. Some of them are kind of hesitant about using that platform. And then you have another flux of clientele who don't even recognize that they need the treatment. They're mm-hmm. kind of battling with the whole adjustment with COVID-19, and not understanding adjustment in itself is mentally challenging. It is a mental issue. So mm-hmm. you're seeing an array of things right now. And my prediction is that it's just going to continue to be a gamut of all three. Especially if the economy keeps going the way it is financially. And then on top of that, people not really focusing on mental right now, they're focusing on financings and household things, because right now school is out here in Texas, so mm-hmm. they're parenting, you know, they're cooking, they're cleaning, they're doing all the things, you know, at home, which if they could have, they would have left the office to go to a therapy session. But now it's kind of harder to balance, you know, being stationary at home.
Absolutely. Do you think, like, because a lot of people have been dropping this word of the new normal. Do you think that this may possibly be the new normal or some kind of form of it? Like, I can kind of see, but I don't know. I'm just curious.
For me, the wording new normal helps not catastrophize the situation. Right. When you think of normal, you think of something that is routine, something that is predictable, something that is usual, something that is steady. So when we add the new normal to it, it makes it feel accepting. It makes us on board for it, rather than looking at it in, you know, a catastrophic mindset. Oh, this is over. We can't go anywhere. We can't do anything. Just by looking at it from the term of the new normal, I think it helps people to kind of adjust a little better without looking at all of the negative sides to, you know, the COVID-19 and the stay home that's in effect.
Yes, yes. Especially dealing with isolation.
Right.
Like, I think when they tried to use the word social distancing, and I think they was trying to synonymously use it with social isolation, but a lot of people took it, it went for good. It was a tip for good as far as like eliminating the possible number of spreading, mm-hmm. but I don't like the idea of, you know, a lot of people, like you mentioned about the new norm, a lot of people normal or repetitive activities were being around others. It made them feel mm-hmm. good, mm-hmm. you know, especially like with those memes people have, they'll say like the introverts, mm-hmm. the extroverts are having a hard time right now because they can't be around people. And I don't think people understood like that is really going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, that is true.
Like it's really a lot of people who cannot deal with social isolation or social distancing. Even though social distancing really stood for when you're in a store, isolation is like, I don't know. It just, I really think that this whole thing, of course it kind of sprung on us in one sense, but it was like, I don't think like each area was taken care of in the process. Like, okay, I understand. Okay, medically, we got to take care of this. It's a virus. Okay, we're going to take care of the wellness of the individual. Okay, we're just going to work on that. And it shows. Mm-hmm. But all the other stuff is kind of like it was sprung on us and they like basically ignored like all of the behavioral. I mean, even with the stay at home, which again, I understand why it was created, but now they're like, okay, some people are really sad. They're emotional. Mm-hmm. Their behaviors have changed because they can't go outside. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah, definitely. What I hear you say is that basically, you know, the rollout wasn't in the best way. Like, we didn't look at all the different factors to what this COVID-19 does as a whole. We kind of looked at it in portions. And I agree. I definitely agree. There's a many sensitive parts than just the wellness part of it.
Yes.
And so that's what I hear you saying, and I definitely agree.
Yeah. So, like, I don't know. I guess what is one of the common things, because I see it a lot on social media. Like, I'm going to be honest. I really haven't been in the field, like, probably about 6 months. So, but I'm noticing, like, a lot of trends of a lot of research and things that are really talking a lot about, like, how basically trying to teach parents and other individuals that's not in the field on how to be resilient, mm-hmm. and how to talk to their kids about it. That's some of the things I have been seeing. A lot of research, a lot of webinars, a lot of videos talking about it.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one, I think, I also put it in the show notes for parents so y'all can see it. NAMI is putting one together. It's like a webinar to talk to parents about how to talk to their kids about COVID-19 and how to be resilient through this. But I've also seen other webinars from other agencies to talk to adults about being resilient. What is your opinion, or what would you probably would say to an individual, maybe a listener, nationally or internationally, that's probably dealing with the social isolation or social distancing or just this whole quarantine or just COVID-19, all mm-hmm. of it. What would you, I guess, suggest or
So your suggestion is targeted to like what they can do to stay safe, or?
Yes. Well, not safe, but I guess I don't want to say the word sane, but some form of stability at this okay. time.
And so just kind of doing like a mental check is one of the things that I encourage everyone to do. Kind of do some mm-hmm. self-reflection on your own part is, you know, how does all this make me feel and how am I reacting to it? Is one of the biggest things that I encourage people to do is to do a mental health check-in with yourself. And I encourage this periodically. It's not something that you just do one day and then once you feel better, you know, you don't do it anymore until you feel, you know, a fluctuation in mood. I encourage people to do it periodically. Make it a part of your routine to do a mental health check-in with yourself, kind of like when we do physical check-ins or kind of when we do mental cognitive check-ins with ourselves to see where we are mentally. You do it periodically and it becomes part of your repertoire. And one of the ways that you do that is you kind of look at, you know, how am I responding to external event? You know, am I isolating? Am I continuing to call my peer, my support group? Am I, you know, overeating? Because overeating is one of the biggest things I've been seeing nationally, period, is that, you know, because we're shut in, it's easier to overeat. It's easier to binge eat. So kind of doing my check-ins, what are my actions playing a part on? Another thing I encourage people to do is to limit their intake of researching the COVID-19, because we know that it can bring about anxiety, it can bring about a shift in mood when it comes to maybe depression. So kind of limit your use, your intake of the COVID-19. You might have to spend an hour a day only researching, and then after that I might tell my family and friends, hey, I have an hour zone, so after that we're not talking about the COVID. I might want to stay away from social media pages that have more COVID prone topics. I might mute my news feed, because if you have an iPhone, it comes periodically. So those are just some mm-hmm. examples of things that you could do to kind of do a mental check-in and kind of reserve your intake of the COVID-19.
Yes. And I hope that like the listeners actually jot down some of those ideas, because they actually
they work. Do.
I mean, even outside of this, and like you mentioned earlier, Jessica, it's an adjustment. Typically when something new occurs or something is removed out of our lives, or we're doing something that's completely different out of our norm, we're actually trying to mm-hmm. adjust to it. So this is kind of one of those, it's not catastrophic, but it's kind of something that kind of took everybody mm-hmm. by surprise. So everybody's trying to adjust and like most people say, pull for straws, or trying to figure out or normalize or try to make logic out of something that nobody really understands per se. They're kind of taking it day by day to even learn and figure out what to do.
Right. And there was no way to prepare for this. So, you know, kind of like you said, the resiliency, how do we continue to move forward? And I want to be clear, because that is the standard, that is the thought process that we got to continue to move forward. It's okay to feel like I'm not moving forward. Those one of your signs to know that I need to reach out for help. Because if I'm pretending to move forward and I'm not moving forward, what do I do next? You seek help.
Yes. And that is definitely the thing to do, is to get assistance. And with that, I would like to know, you know, just my, I guess, asking, as well as the listeners, Jessica, what would you define as your style or background as a therapist? Because I don't think people understand that actually therapy, in the program, we were taught that, you know, it's different theories and stuff like that, and it's different mm-hmm. styles. So one particular style might not be an individual's, that might not fit for a certain person. But if there is a listener that's out there that's probably in the Houston area that would like to see you for therapy, if you could just kind of tell them your style.
Yeah, so I am a cognitive behavior therapist, which kind of what it basically means that I look at the cognitive to kind of change the behavior, to change the outcome of how you think about certain situations. I use different styles, which means I'm very unorthodox is what I consider myself to be. I kind of appease to the learning style of an individual. And we know the different learning styles can be a visual, auditory, you know, kind of hands-on, kinetics kind of learning. So I appease to the different learning styles because it helps build with strengths. So if it's something that I already do in my daily repertoire, it's easier for me to grasp a little better. So what does that mean? Sometimes I might get handouts for us to read. Sometimes I might pull out a dry erase board for the client to kind of write through their what they're feeling. We might have visual aids to help prompt them to what they're feeling, or are not able to reach actualization on what they're feeling. So I'm very unorthodox, and a lot of my clients really particularly seek that out because not everybody is the same, you know, and it's tailoring towards their specific needs. I work with a lot of couples. I like couples therapy, and I like the restorative process of that. I like the restorative process of family therapy. And I work kind of hand in hand with the LGBT community. I have a plethora of those clients. So I kind of do an array of things, but my modality is definitely cognitive behavior focused.
Cool. And that's really, really good that you do, you know, utilize worksheets and just try to make it interactive.
Because what we see on TV is that a therapist is, you know, sitting there talking. But when you go to therapy, a lot of clients are nervous because that's what they're expecting to get. But it's not that at all. Your therapist, you always want someone who's tailoring to your needs. And it's adaptable to make sure you're reaching that level of insight you need to reach. So hopefully one day the media will start portraying us in that light.
Yes, hopefully. I think I seen it maybe like one time as of recent, but not often. They still, I mean, even on comedy shows, they still have like a couch, and, you know, sitting there, and they got like the doodle, and they're doodling instead of listening to what you're saying. Sometimes I think I saw, like, I can't remember which show it was, but the guy turned around his paper and he had drew a whole picture. And I'm like, okay.
Yes. And then the one that comes to mind for me is Acrimony, when Taraji P. Henson was getting therapy. And, girl, you know, her therapist just kind of basically kept repeating what she was saying.
Yes.
So.
And then she was kind of, I don't know. I don't. That show for a whole, that movie is the discussion for a whole other day. It just wasn't. I don't know. And you would think, I guess, like in today, a lot of the writers' room, they would bring in experts actually work in these fields so that their show at least would be somewhat realistic or respectable to the. To the craft, because this is not.
I agree.
You talked earlier, like you said, you was working 12 hours to get the 3,000 hours. Like y'all, I don't know if any of y'all, which we're going to talk about later, but I don't know if any of y'all are trying to get into mental health as a mental health professional, and I mean that's social work or mental health counseling or either psychology. It is not a joke to get these hours. You do have to pay somebody sometimes, some cases. And you got to take tests, and these tests is, you know, which you might spend on some bundles or house the same price. So, but two tests actually for us, but it's not cheap. So when, you know, we look on TV and these shows or movies or whatever in the media, and they're portraying mental health professionals, just individuals that sit and just be monotone and
I've had people come and expecting the Ayana Fix My Life version of therapy.
Wow.
Just tell me what I need to do and fix me. That is false. I can't fix you. I wish I could. I would definitely fix everybody. I'll start with myself. But
okay.
Yeah, the Ayana Fix My Life version of therapy is a false perception too.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's a lot out there in society that kind of goes against, and it doesn't go against the grain at all. It's really just, it just does not portray the field as exactly. It should in some instances. So, yeah, most definitely. But we have individuals like yourself that's actually getting out here and being on podcasts like this podcast to educate people and let them know that, you know, therapy is not just us sitting. We could be sitting in Indian style in the middle of the floor if you feel comfortable.
Right. You can be in my chair and I can be on the couch. It's whatever helps facilitate. Exactly. Yes.
Yes. So it's you know, individuals, if they do come to you, to pretty much let them know, like, hey, you are the expert. I am here to listen and to assist. So, yeah. But girl, this conversation is getting so good. We're going to have to pay some bills and we'll be right back. And we are back. So, it's just that we can kind of shift gears a tad bit, but not so much, because we're still going to talk about, of course, mental health and everything like that. Recently, I had saw an article about a week ago that spoke about a 15-year-old female out in Florida who, but it was Florida or California, it was one of those, and she was an athlete who actually completed suicide. And it was stated that it may have something to do with social isolation, or what we call social distancing, that we are currently, you know, just experiencing everywhere right now. Except for some places, I think they're kind of trying to lift the ban, but the vast majority of us are under some type of stay-at-home ordinance, or not ordinance, but some type of mandate.
Mm-hmm.
That we have to be at home. What are your thoughts in regards to the possible influx of completed or attempts of suicide and doubts of hopelessness and helplessness during this
time? I do see that being a challenge. So many people are at home, mm-hmm. and as you said, the difference between social distancing and isolations are different. And so keeping that in mind, that isolation can, you know, cause people to have more suicidal thoughts. And with so many businesses are being closed, you know, the outlets are definitely limited. So I can see that there being an influx in suicide attempts and suicide completions as this thing continues to pan out. Some, not even just the isolation parts, you know, what happened to the people before that were already having suicidal thoughts before the pandemic, you know, those are thoughts to be considered. Where I was going to, you know, therapy every 2 weeks, or when I was already dealing with life adjustment, and then this happened. You know, so suicide ideation, mm-hmm. is not, you know, one of those things that typically just hits abruptly. Those are things that we call boiling pots. Those are things that were already brewing before this pandemic, you know, kind of taken in. So kind of taken in consideration with that article. We don't know what that young lady was already dealing with before her her completion of suicide. So those are a lot of, there are a lot of factors to consider, but I do believe that this is one of those times that we do need to be on high alert for suicide ideations and, you know, checking on the people, you know, who are in our circle, who are we identify in our support system.
Yes. And like, and it's good you mentioned something about support systems, because, you know, even like I had mentioned earlier, people, especially individuals that get sick often, especially the, you know, the first thing they thought of with COVID-19 was individuals that have issues, pre-existing, health issues. That was the first thing they mentioned. That and an elderly population. So it went from that to then they started identifying healthy individuals that had it. So if a person is kind of like hypervigilant or just constantly worrying often, then this might have been that moment that they probably just thought, okay, I could be this person that may be, that may have COVID, you know, or just, I guess, just constant or persistent thoughts about different things. And then next thing you know, they're helpless. They're like, you know what? Okay. If I have it, then I don't know what to do because I don't have X, Y, Z. And I can't adapt. So most definitely. If it is anybody out there, you know, we will put the well, we can mention that now if you want the hotlines. For someone that, you know, if you are contemplating or having any thoughts of suicide or just feeling helpless or hopeless, Jessica, if you could mention the suicide hotline.
Okay, I'll give the one for the national one, because I normally give out the local one here. And so that one is 1-800-273-TALK is the number. 1-800-273-TALK.
Okay. So you guys, definitely, if you are having any thoughts or just feeling hopeless or just helpless, you know, feel like there's nothing that you could do or anyone could do, lack of support, things like that, there's a line for you to contact that can assist you. They will actually get you assistance no matter where you are. You just tell them your location. So don't think you're in this alone, because, I mean, again, this is a helping field, no matter if we're at work, not at work, no longer working in the field, etc. We're always Jimmy on the spot. We are always there to assist and try to give resources when needed. And, you know, I guess as we're talking about this, Jessica, if you could, like, educate the listeners at this time on which these are three different things, you guys. So, just going to break down each of those. Or what the signs and symptoms may look like. Of course, it does not fit. It's not a one-size-fits-all situation. But just for you to recognize, because oftentimes we as individuals, especially with friends or with loved ones or even with significant others, we kind of is a little blind to the signs, when actually we need to be paying a little bit of attention. And it's not saying that this person, and we're not diagnosing them, we're not asking you to diagnose, but we're just saying, hey, these are some of the signs, so that if this person it has been experiencing this, or been kind of telling you this, even in confidence, that you can kind of assist them to getting treatment. Not necessarily treatment, like going into a hospital, but treatment as in trying to speak with the therapist and, you know, moving from there, just kind of giving them the information. So here are the ones, because these are three that I hear and see often on social media, and just in conversation in the public or anywhere. If you could just provide the listeners with information on depression, anxiety, and suicidal
ideation. For depression, I kind of, you know, that term is kind of used loosely. You know, when we say, oh, I'm so depressed, or girl, you depressed, or man, so-and-so depressed. You know, that term is used so loosely, and it's one of those things that we don't really look at the severity of the meaning behind depression.
Yes.
It is a diagnosable disorder. And it's one of those things that you really, really want to, you know, be knowledgeable about. Even if you're just a community member, you want to know some things about depression. So some common signs of depression. Keep in mind that all these signs and symptoms in each one that you've asked me to identify, they all look different in different individuals. It's not a one fits all. So if you feel like you're experiencing any of some of these signs, you definitely want to seek help. You know, your local therapist, your PCP doctor, you want to reach out to them just to see, you know, are you aligned with some of the signs and symptoms of each. And so for depression, as we talked about isolation, depression also looks like, you know, kind of being guarded, sleep problems, feeling hopeless. Some people feel like excessive shift in moods, feeling sad, withdrawn from everybody, kind of staying to myself. My personal appearance may be affected. I might not consume hygiene the way that I used to before. I might have thoughts about, you know, harming myself or maybe someone else. I might have went through something traumatic in my past that keeps reoccurring. So different things. These are just some signs, and these also kind of look the same with suicidal ideation. These are some of the signs to look for when you might start to experience suicidal ideation, is that, you know, I might feel sad and I might feel withdrawn. My sleep might be bothered. My appetite might look different. I might have shifted moods. The people that I used to seek out to, I might be withdrawn from. Sex might even be a factor. I might start doing risky behaviors, such as binge drinking, reckless driving, engaging in unsafe sex. Drug and alcohol use may become more of a coping skill for me, or something that I seek out more to. So those kind of look a little same, kind of the same in depression and as it is in suicide ideation. There's this myth about suicide ideation when people start to give away things that, like, hey, you can have my shirt, come by and get my dog, things like that. There's this myth that people give away things, and that's not always the case. It looks different across, you know, the platform of people, but at the same time, you want to be aware of that myth too. That the myth that I can ask someone if they're suicidal, that's a myth. You definitely want to ask someone if they're feeling suicidal. That doesn't make them attempt, you know. So being aware of my own recollection, can I even ask this person if they're suicidal? Do I have to be timid? Do I have to kind of dance around it? You can definitely ask someone if they're having thoughts of suicide, and you don't have to be a professional to ask that question. But I do encourage you to be an opening ear and help them to seek resources. The signs and symptoms for anxiety, this kind of looks like a person have racing thoughts. I'm unable to concentrate. I feel fatigued. I might have sweating palms. I might have excessive worrying, fear, feeling of doom. Some people even vomit or feel nauseated. I might tremble. These are things that anxiety, I know some people say it feels like my chest is really heavy. And so anxiety looks different in many ways, but just some physical symptoms that we can see is the sweating, the trembling, but the things that the person may be dealing with might not be physical, like the racing thoughts and the pounding heartbeat, unwanted thoughts, things like that. And so The things that we cannot see are the things that we want to be more cognitive about. These are things that we want to ask people. So I'm glad you asked that question, because not all signs and symptoms we can see, we can visually see. It might be something more internal that the person is going with that we have to actually ask that question. But the things that we can see is the isolation and the trembling and the sweating. Those are things that might prompt us to ask the question.
Yes. Yeah, because I can imagine a lot of maybe EMTs, mm-hmm. or people that work like in the hospital that probably have seen a couple of what may appear as a heart attack or shortness of breath or statements of chest pain that may actually exactly. be an anxiety attack. So, I can even say I even seen it as far as an individual possibly having a stroke once, or like a loss of, like complete loss of like, I guess retaining of their limbs, like the persistent shaking and things due to persistent anxiety attacks, so constant anxiety attacks that weren't taken, identified or noted. So
it is.
It's serious out here, y'all. Like this is not. Like, as I always used to tell clients or just individuals, period, even when I was speaking, I would mention that, like, our mental, our psychological, and our physiological actually are, like, besties. Mm-hmm. They're side by side. If one is failing, the other one is going to fail, too. And sometimes our mental, our, like, our symptoms sometimes do appear mm-hmm. physical after so long of fighting with it mentally, because we probably ignored it, or we're just like, oh, just it's nothing wrong. It's just me having a day. And me having a day might go into 2 days. 2 days going into three, a week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, a month, years, you know, or it may just lay dormant, or it could be a situation that may occur that take place in your life that's traumatic, and here we are again experiencing this. And it might not be, you can kind of just shove off or cope, which you did mention something dealing with coping, Jessica. Coping mechanisms. A lot of us may think that shopping, because I've seen a lot of it, is shopping and drinking. Shopping, drinking, and having sex. I think those are like the three things that a lot of people are doing right now to cope. And just if you could take a moment to kind of inform the listeners, it's not bad, y'all, but if you're doing it a lot, or just as far as like drinking and using alcohol, I would say, out of the three, if you could just kind of inform the listeners on like what is healthy coping mechanism and what is not.
So the healthy coping mechanisms are things that we kind of already do in our everyday life, that we feel that our strengths are things that we like kind of enjoy doing, like hobbies or things like writing. Phone with friends could be a coping mechanism. What else are some things that, you know, a person could like? For me, coping could be when I want to do something challenging, I might cook, because I'm not a cooker. So if I want to kind of appeal to that challenging moment, I might cook. So things of this nature are considered healthy coping skills. Things are not that are kind of detrimental or things that could be overused. Unhealthy coping skills, I always mm-hmm. like to say, is not really the unhealthy part. It's the things that we do in excessiveness. And so excessiveness, I might, you know, marijuana. Marijuana is definitely one of those things that people do a lot, especially in our culture. Marijuana is very normalized, and you know, oh, I do it, it eases my mind for anxiety, or it helps me sleep, or it calms me down. But marijuana is definitely a DSM diagnosable disorder, cannabis use. So you want to be mindful of marijuana use. Alcoholism is a depressant. So, you know, while you might feel up, alcohol is a depressant. So once you're coming down, what happens? You start to feel, you know, depressed. And so shopping, like you said, shopping is one of those things where our endorphins are running. We get that adrenaline, putting things in our cart. And granted that shopping can be something that we do as a healthy coping, once it becomes excessive is the problem. So I would encourage you to minimize the use of online shopping. It's real prevalent right now. Minimize your use of online shopping for the time being, because it becomes excessive. Sex, not so much, is unhealthy. It's just how we're engaging in sex. Are we using protection? Are we staying safe when we use our right to be sexually active?
I think those are like the three that people are mostly engaging in, if it's not like kind of getting on like TikTok and things like that. I guess those like processing addictions per se, of just kind of like getting on social media, checking like to see who maybe liked the post, or just those feelings of being, I guess, attention, or you know, just trying to cope pretty much, just kind of getting around to just the idea that people are constantly like doing a little bit more than usual because people have a little bit more time than they normally would have, especially if they're like working from home or just laid off from their job or furloughed from their job or just fired from their job completely because maybe the company has gone out of business during this time. But I know and noted that a lot of people are engaging in a lot of this during this time of social isolation, or not social isolation, mm-hmm. but social distancing per se.
Definitely. Very true. So,
yeah, so it's good that you did mention that, and just kind of letting everyone know that, you know, these are things that you kind of need to kind of take some heed to, especially that today ironically is with people who call 420. Yeah. So
the significance, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so as the phrase goes, mm-hmm. you know, what comes up must come down. Actually, so that even goes for gravity and everything else, especially our emotions. So if you are kind of using substances, kind of keep that in mind. Or even if you're shopping or any other behaviors that may be constant or persistent that are kind of added to your daily life that emotionally will kind of take, not prisoners, but some emotions is taking place, some feelings is taking place in the process. Even with shopping and everything like that, like you have to have it, I have to have it, I have to have it, or the idea of this may make, by engaging in this, it may make me feel better. So just kind of, I guess, like you said, just taking those steps to try to figure out other activities to do.
Definitely, I definitely agree.
Yeah. And going back to just kind of, because it kind of got a little bit off, but it's okay. The conversation pertaining to the signs and symptoms for anxiety and everything, I do want to give a text line. Y'all got a hotline for suicide. You also got a text line, text crisis line, that you guys can contact at any time, and they will write you back. That will give you assistance as well. And you can use it 24/7 out of the day. You text HOME HOME to 741741, and they'll connect you with someone. So, and I put it in the show notes as well for you guys to utilize. Even if you got a loved one at your home and you're like, okay, look, let's kind of have this discussion. You know, I've been identifying some things that's been kind of going on. Is everything cool? You know, do you feel that you may need to talk to somebody, or, you know, however you kind of want to go by that. But, and also too, there are also steps that you can actually, you as an individual that's trying to not confront, but talk to a loved one about what they're doing. Actually, you can speak to a therapist about that too.
Right.
Kind of interesting. So, it's always good to kind of reach out for assistance, and you can use this crisis hotline to reach out to someone even about that, or just get them to reach out to try to get some help. They can get connected as need be. So, I think we're kind of getting close to the end of the episode, but I want to ask like one more question. Because we talk so much about like getting people to, or identifying the signs and symptoms of different, the most top three that we see mental health related issues or topics. But what are your thoughts, especially at a time like this? Because there are people that's going to say, I don't need mental health treatment because it's just not one of those things. And sometimes it's because it's a taboo, and you know, being that we both from the South, and like this whole ordeal, or just seeing the therapist, and not just the stuff that's on in the media, but I guess it's kind of been embedded in some households that what goes on in this house stays. What is your thoughts on informing people that may feel that it's not needed, or may identify it as a taboo? How would you explain to them the importance of seeking mental health treatment, or seeking a mental health professional for it? Mm-hmm.
Generational trauma is definitely real. And, you know, unbeknownst to us, that some things from our generations are passed down, kind of like, I always like to give the example is what you were taught about finances, where you taught about finances, you know, in our culture, not a lot of times families are teaching children, you know, in our millennial about the use of finances, how to plan for buying a house and student loans and credit, kind of like that. If that's not being passed down, think about all the generational things that have been passed down. The what happens in this house stays in this house, pray about it. Go to church and tell God, and, you know, repent. Those type of things are masking the real issue. It's masking the real issue. Granted that spirituality is definitely a strength when coming to therapy. Therapy never neglects your spirituality. But at the same time, I need some other things. I need to look at my mind. I need to see what I've been consuming. And is it healthy? Am I passing it down unbeknownst to my children? Or am I going about this with other relationships in my circle? So I always encourage people not to just think about therapy as for going because something is wrong. Go to therapy for maintenance. You know, go to therapy for maintenance. I heard one person say, yes, I go to therapy to vent. Because sometimes I tell my friends too much, and I want a different pair of ears to listen to me. Or I want to, you know, kind of dissect what I'm thinking or what I'm going through. Don't just think of therapy as something is wrong and I have to be fixed. You know, kind of like we do our checkups. We're not going to get checkups because something is wrong. We're going to do checkups because of maintenance. And so think of therapy as like, therapy helps you uncover things that you probably have never thought about. Things that you have thought about, it helps you to see it in a different point of view. So kind of look at therapy as a way to to kind of do maintenance, in a so to speak. If nothing is wrong, there's definitely something you're adjusting to that you could be adjusting better to. So while people all are for physical, I am a firm believer that mental is just as important as physical well-being. And I'm only as good as I treat my mind, because my body will follow.
Absolutely. I think that a lot of people eventually, I think people are going to be a little bit more open to it. But I think that it's kind of like a play on word that is often talked about, but it's kind of like in different ways. It's just most people like would rather like do the check-ins, but when they identify as a problem, they're kind of like, okay, I don't know if there's really any resources out there, but when it really is. So I think people are kind of slowly but surely are going to be a little bit more apt to it.
Right.
To
I agree. And therapy is not one of those things that you market for right now. It's one of those things that people are acknowledging and they're actually seeking help for.
Yes. You got to be ready. It's an eye-opener, you guys, though.
It is, and I'm a therapist who has a therapist, so I believe in therapy.
Yes, girl, me too. Yeah, I think when people, when you tell people that, though, they're like, okay, but I don't understand how you're going to get, well, I mean, it's just like an empty glass. If we're trying to fill you up from an empty glass, then, I mean, I don't even see how that's...
It's like telling your doctor not to have a doctor.
Yes. Like, we got to be full, too. So
I definitely agree. Definitely.
And I am just, thankful to have you on this episode, and just, girl, you're welcome. They have individuals like yourself that are, pretty much set the tone and just constantly striving or doing research or find out information of how to help others. I mean, being relevant, because I think a lot of people think that like counselors are behind and they only got just one way of connecting, but you mentioned earlier that you actually make it customized, that you customize each session according to the need of the individual. So I'm hoping that someone who may be kind of contemplating on whether or not they need to go to therapy, kind of take a moment to kind of do a little bit of research, maybe on someone like yourself, if they are in the Houston area, or just other mental health professionals in their area that can assist them. Of course, you have to go through different steps. So it's not just, okay, session one is just going to be a straight up session, unless you just want it to be. But that they actually can go out and really feel comfortable. It's not like dating, but it kind of is. It's pretty cool. But I'm excited to know that you're doing a really, really, really cool job out there and trying to get others involved. And like you said, you got like two private practices in the area, so of course it's not just you and those. So you got other like-minded professionals that's working with you to help the culture, to help the community. So it's really cool. Before we do close out this episode, I do want to allow you the opportunity to inform our listeners on any of your upcoming events or how to reach out to you. Because, of course, they got the name of your private practice, but if you could restate that again or any type of contact information.
Yes,
that you
so
would like to provide
my website is www.rightmentality.org. You can go on there and visit services, and you can actually schedule an appointment, but you have to be local in Texas. Due to licensure laws, I only can practice in the state of Texas. So if you're local in the state of Texas and would like to schedule an appointment for mental health services, again, that website is www.rightmentality.org. Another project I am working on, I am writing my first urban fiction book that is based in Jackson, Mississippi. So if you're someone who likes urban fiction and wants to read about, a young teen girl who's going through things in Mississippi, is definitely not a mental health book, I can tell you that. But she gets into a lot of things. She gets pregnant at 14. And her parents kind of just basically never deal with the issue, and she keeps getting to a lot of mischievous ways. So if you want to purchase that book, you can definitely purchase at www.authorjessicasherrell.com. And the book is also on Amazon. You can just type in "If Only They Knew" on Amazon to purchase that book. Again, you can go to the website at www.authorjessicasherrell.com, or you can type in "If Only They Knew" on Amazon. Make sure you have the book section, the tab selected in order to find the book. So those are my projects. That's how you can reach me. It was great being on this platform. Hopefully that you've learned something new. If you haven't learned new, I hope you will share with someone else, and that they can continue to educate themselves about mental health, and sharing this platform around will definitely get the word out about mental health.
Yes. And again, thank you, girl, for being on the show. Because
you're so welcome. Like,
this should really help out some individuals. And to check out your book. I had forgot to mention that earlier, that you did write a book. So maybe I may have you back on or in the future to talk about your book.
Probably yes, that's the goal.
By that time. talk about your book and just the things that you have going on. But for me, I will say, I am working on a couple of things. One, looking for some queen ambassadors for my boutique, The Crown Closet, which I will be uploading some more items in the Royal Interview collection, which basically is a collection for women to, find like their latest like interview outfits, pretty much, for business interviews. Preferably pageant interviews, because it's kind of why they're a little bit extra, per se, for some people. But that collection, as well as the upcoming swim fit line that I'm putting out, that's going to come out in June. So looking for, like I said earlier, looking for some queen ambassadors, and as well as putting out this new line. I'm excited about both of those opportunities. Which the Queen Ambassador search will begin May the 1st and will end May 31st. So if you're kind of following me, you'll see that information, which you guys should be, because that's how you'll see like who's going to be on the next episodes of the podcast, and just any information related to the individuals that are on the show, because I love like reposting what they're doing out in the communities far past the episode. I always kind of give you your little shout outs or whatever. Because I always like to, maintain networking opportunities. So until next week, which is episode 10. So I made the double digits now for podcast episodes. And I hope you all have a great week.
Thank you.
Bye.